The Farm in the Countryside podcast is brought to you by Pivot BioProven. Get what you paid for, the nitrogen that stays put, weather or not. Learn more at pivotbio.com. Welcome to Farming the Countryside. I'm Andrew McRae. Planters can put a lot of seed in the ground very quickly these days, but there are common mistakes that can cost you a lot of money. Learn what most people forget before they head to the field. We'll talk to a guy that troubleshoots many problems, and he'll help us avoid those common mistakes. Plus, I'll take you to a farm that is thriving by raising worms. Not just any kind of worm, but a special worm that has this farmer converting old hog houses into a thriving business. It's all on this edition of Farming the Countryside. This winter, we worked on our planter, replacing some of the worn pieces and getting it ready for the spring. Every year, I think we're ready to head straight to the field, only to find out that once we get there, we weren't really ready to head to the field. It's tempting to rush to get the seed in the ground quickly at times, and while we have good intentions, there are several items that, if not corrected, can cause large and lasting problems with the crop. James Weaver's on many farms each year, working on a variety of precision agriculture applications for MFA. I ask him to give us some tips on preparing for the planting season from his years of experience troubleshooting planter problems.
James, first of all, tell me what the weather's like around where you're at. I suppose it looks like we're still a little ways from planting where you're at.
I'd say we're pretty good ways out. We were soggy, and it's raining right now, and I think it's going to be soggier by the end of the day.
I think that's right. You know, this is a typical March day. This is radio or podcast. People can't see it, but I'm sitting in a feed truck with heavy clothes and my big mud boots on. And a lot of March days, it looks like you're forever away from planting. And then all of a sudden it gets sunny and you feel like you're behind. So we've got some of those days coming.
Absolutely. This is typical March weather. And what I try to tell everyone is use this March weather to your advantage to be ready whenever things pop off in April.
Well, and that's what we want to talk about. We're going to talk specifically about planters. And I know that some folks listening to this have done lots of work already on their planters. In fact, we've reworked ours here over the winter. We had time to do it. But still, even for those that have done some work, there's a lot of times things you need to go to right before the field. And we're going to try to make the conversation somewhat general because I know we've got folks listening that may have very new planters. And we've got some folks that are using a little bit older models. So there's things to think about. No matter what you're using. Let's start with this. I think one of the things that you talk about quite a bit before I go to the field is looking at my meters. Is that where you like to start when you're thinking about getting ready to go plant in the spring?
Absolutely. Meters are one thing that gets overlooked. They're one of the most important things whenever it comes to seed singulation. Those doubles and those skips that you get whenever your meters are off or your brush needs to be replaced, those are the things that create runt pigs in the field that can be real yield robbers. So I harp on everyone. This is a great time. There's lots of locations around that will run your meters, and we get that singulation pounded out to where every seed has the same space and the same depth.
What about when I'm hooking up the planter? You know, one thing that you have written about that I think about a lot, thanks to folks like you telling me, is about getting that planter hooked up, what I'll say, level behind the drawbar of the tractor.
A lot of newer planters now come with downforce that help adjust with your planter not being level, but having your 7x7 beam or whatever it may be, having it level, having every box at either end on your pitch and yaw for where the seed trenches are dug, having that level is absolutely crucial whenever you get to the field.
What about my vacuum pressure? I think every time we go to the field to start the year, we have trouble with vacuum pressure. What should I be thinking about when it comes to vacuum?
Well, it's a great practice to get your tractor hooked up. Another thing, not only with checking your pressure before you have seed in there when you're sitting in front of the shed hooking everything up, it's also a great time to check all your gauges. A lot of these tractors are used only for planting. That's not the case with everyone, but it's a great opportunity to also check your gauges. Check your vacuum, check your gauges, make sure everything's lining up from the year before and you don't have anything that you need to do either in the cab of the tractor or on the planter itself.
Do you think for a lot of us, do we need somebody to help us with some of that? I know that we've run into situations where we feel like that we know a lot, but we don't know everything. Do you find yourself going out to a lot of farms just to look at those types of things first before any seed goes in the ground?
I do. With your more progressive planters, as more technology gets on there, there are more things that you need to check. There are more things that are easily forgotten. There's a lot of guys like me out there, precision guys in the field. John Deere has a whole precision team that they use. Guys like us, we have a checklist every time we show up to the farm of things that need to go down through and be checked. If you have a good relationship with your precision guy, I'm sure that he would not have a problem coming out looking things over, because it's easier to fix it in front of the shed than after it's full of seed in the field, because everyone's busy at that point.
That is right, and I've had plenty of those times where we had to fix it in the field with a lot of seed in it. That's not as much fun. But it's never fun, but
no,
not good.
No, it's very very unpleasant, and the number of planters out there far outnumber the number of precision employees out there. So when it gets in season, it gets really hard to get everyone taken care of in the field.
Let's talk about no-till for just a second, because depending on where you're at, that could be more or less the crop conditions that you're going to use. With no-till, I may have some coulters and things on the front. How should I have those adjusted? Because just a little adjustment can make a big difference.
Absolutely. You always want to make sure that that your seed trench is going to be equal throughout. A poor seed trench closure, it will increase the amount of lodging. You can have crooked necks. We always want to get our coulter set, and we always want to get our depth set to about 2 1/4 inches to the top of the seed. This helps with temperature fluctuations and it help with developing the plants.
Is there any way that I can make sure that depth is consistent? I know that, you know, other than getting out and just digging, is that still my best way? There's a lot of things we can have on the planter that shows us, but do I still just need to get out and just dig those and see what's going on?
What I recommend is 100% get out and dig, hook your planter on to the tractor, get a little seed in there, go out to a grass patch or a little back piece of a yard or a pasture, and go in there. It's similar to a no-till situation. Go in there, do 2 or 3 strips, different ones, and dig each one, measure each one out, and kind of see where you're at.
Now, if I'm not in a no-till situation, does the recommendation change at all?
As far as seed depth and the leveling of the planter, no, not in my opinion. Typically, there's not as much heavy tillage going on. There's a lot of light tillage compared to, you know, the no-till. When you have that nice seed bed, the variation goes out with light tillage, or, you know, even heavy tillage coming back over the top with a light tillage. The variations aren't as much, but having said that, the depth is still the most important thing to me.
What about sometimes with no-till situations, we've got row cleaners. How should those be running on my planter?
I see a lot of different variations. It's nice to have them raised just a bit. I see a lot of spike and round closures as a combination. That is probably my favorite way to do it. It's really important to remember that those are not tillage tools. We just want to tickle the ground. We want to get that seed trench covered nicely, and we don't want them digging down too deep.
Whenever we hit spring, we don't know what we're going to get for planting conditions, and certainly a lot of us, when you look at the calendar, you look at the weather, last year being a good example, we want to get in the field and get going. So you do see a lot of fields. What about my planting conditions and when I'm going to plant and how that's going to affect most likely how that seed comes up and affects my yield in the end?
The number one factor to yield, in my opinion, are the soil conditions at planting. It's not the date of the week or the date of the month, the time of the year. It's the conditions of the field that's going to determine the yield at the end of the year. So whether it be May 1st or April 1st, I'd never recommend planting until the soil conditions absolutely call for it. Anytime someone muds seed in, you can instantly tell by the time you get to July in a field-by-field situation, you can tell the guy that waited for the conditions to be correct and the guy that got in a hurry. One thing I always stress, some guys don't agree with this. In the state of Missouri, I believe that we have 60 days that are suitable for planting corn, and it's the entire month of April and the entire month of May. In those 2 months, there's a lot of time to get your corn planted. There's no reason to rush to the field when conditions don't call for it.
And I suppose even last year, those that planted in June, the way the fall fell, June planting was probably all right for a lot of people too.
Absolutely. I saw a lot of great yields for late planted corn. It's a common misconception that corn has to be planted this early. Whenever you look at the advances that we've had in corn hybrids, they can adjust when they're planted a lot better than the older hybrids. I saw a lot of great June planted corn last year, and reason being, the guys waited until the conditions were correct to get the seed in the ground.
You know, when we talk about conditions being correct, I think a lot of us, we'd say, well, I can just see it when I know that it's right. But do you have some factors that you look at as far as soil temperature or the way that soil, the way that seed's going in the soil that you'd say, okay, I think we're good now? Do you have any things that you like to use as a rule of thumb?
Obviously, soil temperature is a huge one, which varies from the top of my area that I cover to the bottom. As you get farther south, obviously the seed gets, or the soil temperature gets warmer faster. But as far as overall soil conditions, if you've got anything sticking to your planter, if your seed trenches aren't closing, or you're throwing hunks of mud with your closing wheels trying to get over the top of the seed trench, it is not time to plant. It is too wet. For the most part, as long as things aren't sticking, I'd say you're good to go. But like I said, just slow down. And the biggest thing I see is, like I said, guys get in there one day too early. That one day is not going to kill you. One more day of sunshine to dry at the top of that seed bed can make a world of difference whenever it comes to harvest.
I know I mentioned up front we would talk about a variety of planters. What about some older models? Are there some things specific with older model planters that we should think about that we may not think about as much with newer models?
A lot of times people will forget. A lot of these chains that run the gears on a lot of ground-driven planters, a lot of times they are not checked, they're not oiled, they're not greased. Just simple things like going through each one of your chains, each one of your drive chains, make sure that you don't have big rust spots, you don't have big hunks of corrosion hanging off of the chains. Those are little things that I see all the time that I get calls on in the field that very easily could have been handled before we even went out.
As you think about newer planters, we've got a lot of, we'll say, gadgets and different things now that we can use to monitor. But what am I not thinking about if I have a newer planter? And, we sometimes lull ourselves to sleep thinking, well, I'm good because I can see these different things on the screen and I've got this technology. What things do I need to be thinking about with newer planters that you see get often overlooked?
The biggest thing I see get overlooked that I have to try to replace in the field are seed tube sensors, which is pretty funny to me just because seed tube sensors are one of the easiest things that we can check. We don't need GPS. We don't need to be outside. All we need is power to the planter. It's easy to pop that box off, get a little brush, run it down through your seed sensor, have someone sitting in the cab telling you whether or not that sensor's going off. Seed sensors is a big one, and then clutches as well. Most of your planters, whether they be air clutches or electric clutches, vacuum clutches, either way, you can get in the cab, flip each one of those on and off. That clutch should click, and you can very clearly hear the click. If you don't hear a click, that clutch is not clutching, and it will plant all the time. But those are the two big ones, feed tube sensors and clutches. They're very easy to check. You can do it in the shed. And like I said, you don't have to be running. It's easier to get on top of those things in the shed. Once you get in the field and have to take things apart, it's really inconvenient.
One of the things that I've seen you write about is the speed I go through the field. And we have planters now that are high-speed planters, but do you still say, watch my speed? Is that one of the big factors we don't think about?
100%. With the size that planters are now, I know guys are going over more acres, but that's why we have bigger planters. They've adjusted the planter size to be able to drive the same speed and get the same amount of acres done regardless of how fast you drive. I'm personally not a fan of high-speed planters. One thing I will say, which I've come into contact with the past couple years that's really contradicted, some of the higher speed planters do need to be run somewhere between 5 and 6 miles an hour minimum. They are designed to go 5 or 6 to maximize singulation. If you do not have a high-speed planter, I recommend 4 to 5 miles an hour. That will maximize your singulation along with productivity.
What things have we not discussed that we should? Because, again, you're out there with folks in the field, and you see a lot of things every spring.
Very simple things. The biggest thing I haven't covered, this will sound funny, make sure everything's plugged in. That happens all the time. At least once a year, I'll get called out to a farm with an angry farmer, and I'll get out there, and something won't be plugged in. Check and make sure everything's plugged in. It's very easy to do on your displays. You can go in, you can see whether modules are responding or not responding, whether clutches are responding or not responding. That could be as simple as plugging something in. The next thing I see is grease. And grease gets overlooked a lot. Grease is very important. It's one of those things that can, very simple, a $2 tube of grease can save you $1,000 down the road. Those are the two biggest things. Check your connections, check your grease, and along with check your cables. A lot of times when these planters get put in the back of the barn or, you know, get buried behind a combine head or something like that, there's mice, there's rats. Go through, make sure you don't have any broken cables, anything that's been chewed through, and follow them all the way up through the cab. Make sure you didn't get mice in the cab. They can really cause you a headache if you don't get those taken care of before you get there.
I'll plan to get James back on the podcast to talk a bit about sprayer troubleshooting as well. That's another piece of precision equipment that has him regularly out in the fields, so I'll know he'll have some good advice on getting ready for the spray season too. We need to take a break. Farming the Countryside is sponsored by Pivot BioProven. Everyone knows that plants need nitrogen to grow, and now there's a way to make sure corn plants have the nitrogen they need every day. Synthetic nitrogen is susceptible to loss, and applying mid-season can be time-consuming and costly, if you can even get in the field at all. Pivot BioProven's nitrogen-producing microbes bond tightly to corn roots, transferring ammonia to the corn plant each day. Unlike synthetic nitrogen, Pivot BioProven is not washed away, making crop yields more productive and more predictable. Pivot BioProven, nitrogen that stays put, whether or not. I've been in broadcasting for about 25 years. In that time, I've occasionally done some interviews about food, and I've gotten a taste of some pretty amazing items. That's the case for this next interview, at least the tasting part. But what I was asked to eat was a worm. I did, and it wasn't all that bad, actually. It was a part of my visit with Cheryl Powers, who founded a unique farming operation that is raising livestock. It's a niche market that is helping some farmers thrive. Cheryl simply began by sharing where and how they got their start.
We're located in Nebraska. We have two sites in Nebraska. I actually live in Lincoln, and that's where kind of our headquarters is located at.
Before we get into your business today, give me a little of your background, because it's certainly agricultural.
Yes, I grew up on a family farm in northeast Nebraska and was very involved in taking care of our cattle and hogs. And so much so that now my mom has told me she really thought I would marry a farmer, and so that didn't happen. But that does not mean that I still do not have a big interest in agriculture. As the saying goes, you can take the girl out of the country, but you can't take the country out of the girl. And so that's truly where I am at. And I wanted to get involved in agriculture in some way. And my personality is quirky enough that I wanted to do something that was a little bit unique and a little bit of a challenge. And that's what we have been doing.
So take me back. How far are we talking whenever you see an interesting idea that you're going to develop into a business?
This probably started about 4 years ago. I was aware of a local company that was in Lincoln, Nebraska, that was called Bug Eater Foods, and they were using cricket protein to make different food products. And at first I was disgusted by it, like a lot of people probably are in Nebraska. And but the more I looked into it, the more I realized it was a very good protein source. And because it's comes from an animal, it's considered a complete protein with essential amino acids and fatty acids. And it started to intrigue me more and more over the years. And I thought, well, I'm going to watch this agriculture, this insect agriculture industry, and see if this is going to trend upward or if it's going to be a flash in the pan and disappear. And by all signs, it kind of keeps growing and growing and growing. And so it got to the point where basically my husband said, "You've been talking about this for 2 years. What are you waiting for?" And I thought, good question. What am I waiting for? And so that's where we kind of decided I'm going to do something about it. Now or never, let's do it.
So did you start with crickets then? Is that what you began with?
No, we actually, with mealworms. Crickets, for whatever reason, do not match my personality. I have bad experiences in the past where things jumping on me that scare me, and just so crickets, because they can jump on you, and grasshoppers, I steer away from them. The mealworms, they do not jump, they do not fly, they stay put, they cannot crawl out. If you put them in a container that's slick on the sides and only has to be maybe 3 inches deep, and they cannot get out. And so that appealed to my personality of not liking to be surprised unnecessarily.
We've heard of mealworms, but what is a mealworm?
So it's the larva of the darkling beetle. It's about at full size, the larva is about an inch long or so. And it, when dried, it has about 55% protein and about 20% crude fat or so. And then it's got some, because of the chitin in it, it has some nice fiber as well to it. But it's got a lot of different essential amino acids and fatty acids that make it to be a nice alternative protein supplement.
So certainly it has the protein characteristics, but I'm sure people listening to this are going to say, yeah, but why would I eat mealworms when I want to get protein some other way? So what is the market? Because you've certainly found one.
Well, our market, initially, we recognize that in the food industry that there's still a cringe factor there. And so when we started growing, we thought, well, how can we get some income right away? So we have started with selling them live to different markets, different customer segments, whether it's your exotic pets, your wild bird lovers, your chickens. And to go back to why would I want to use for the food, the market, it's going to be a niche market. The market that I see is going to be incorporating it into other foods. For example, if you're a person who takes whey protein, there's some people that cannot take whey protein supplements because if they're lactose intolerant, they couldn't take it. Plant protein isn't as a complete of protein as the mealworms are because they are an animal. And so there's going to be a niche market for those people who are looking for supplemental protein in different forms. And it's dairy-free, you know, it's non-GMO, soy-free. And so that's kind of the market that we're going to be looking for. Incorporating into foods that maybe, because we recognize a lot of people, when they see a worm, they're probably going to eat it. Although I do have one for you over there for you to try. And so, but being able, if it's in a protein or a flour, they can incorporate it into other foods and make it a little more higher protein impact.
You mentioned crickets and other insects beforehand. Is there something that makes mealworms better than those other protein sources like crickets, or is it a certain application for mealworms and protein?
I wouldn't say it's better. It's just another form. Okay. Some people like the taste of mealworms over some of the other insects because if you were to eat it when it's dried, it would taste kind of like a whole sunflower seed if you eat the shell and all. And so it's a very mild, kind of slightly nutty flavor. And actually, we have not tried this yet, but supposedly what you raise them on can also change the flavor profile of them. And so if you wanted to make them have a certain flavor, then you raise them in that type of a bedding or food source.
So a lot of listeners are familiar with raising livestock. Your livestock then are far different. So give me the life cycle of raising these mealworms.
Well, our livestock has 6 legs, first of all, which makes it a little unique. The life cycle is actually quite long, more than what you would think. I believe you can get from an egg to a broiler in about 6 to 7 weeks, a chicken from there. for us, from egg to when we harvest, it's 3.5 to 4 months, depending on, you know, and just like regular livestock, it's a little bit unpredictable. You think you're going to have a tray ready to harvest, and 2 weeks later, it's there to harvest, to, you know, take to market, you might say. Or you think you got 2 weeks away and it's ready now. And so, you know, it's because it's a living organism, you can't rush it, and it's going to take its time. It's going to work, you know, when it's ready to. It's going to be, you can't push some things. So, and like other farms, we have to keep so much breeding stock back to become the next generation. And so it has been a trial and error, to be quite honest. Unlike cattle livestock or hogs or poultry, if you need assistance, you can go to your local county extension office, your local veterinarian, wherever, to get assistance. For us, there was no one we could go to, and we had to kind of look off of YouTube videos and research papers and try to figure out, because it's one thing to raise a small colony to feed one leopard gecko versus filling up a whole building and trying to figure out, because we have to be able to keep a constant supply on hand where every week we can harvest some. And so there's a lot of some balancing you have to do with that, and to try to guess some of that when it's going to work.
Right. So you keep a certain number of beetles just to have producing new larvae that you're going to need to make mealworms.
Yes, about, we try to keep a good, at least 10% of them back. And so, and one of the things we're really proud of is we are searching to build to basically have zero waste. So the larva is the most highly desired of it. The beetles, they will actually age out, and after about 8 weeks, they're just, their reproductive time is dwindled, and then they'll eventually start to die off. So we have actually kind of started to kind of market a poultry mix where you can use those aged out beetles. Chickens still love them. You know, they like to be able to chase them. They still kind of desires their hunt, you know, satisfies their hunt and peck desire. But also we're looking into maybe incorporating them into something that could maybe be used as a wild bird treat or some sort. We're kind of experimenting with some products that we could use them for. And then, believe it or not, with, you know, you have a live animal, and so you have waste. And so we are actually getting ready to market the frass, which is their manure. And it is basically odorless. And I don't think there's very many farms that you can walk in. So if we walk in our farm, it smells slightly of wheat bran, and that's about it. There's no odor to it, which is very unique. So it makes it for a great fertilizer, and I kind of laughingly say we collect it from rear to bag. I mean, literally, we don't dry it, we don't process it. It's as it is right there. So we're selling that now, getting ready to sell that. So between the larva and the frass and the aged out beetles, we'll have zero waste, which is very sustainable.
The frass is used for what?
Plants. It's a fertilizer.
Okay.
And so when a mealworm grows, it sheds its skin. And that skin has, it's called an exoskeleton, contains chitin in it. And there's been some nice research studies that have talked about the benefits of the chitin in the frass and how it can help boost a plant's immune system. So very, very unique. And so that's kind of, you know, one of the things we can, and it can be also considered a natural organic product. And one of the things that benefits is also nice of it is that for gardeners who want to use it, you do not have to worry about there being weeds or seeds in the manure that will grow in your garden that you don't want. So that's a nice benefit as well.
Right now, are you selling most of this just direct from your operation?
Yes, direct. So we have two farms. We have one farm that's in northeast Nebraska and one farm that's in south central Nebraska. And I have two other women co-founders, and they actually live on the active farms, and they are growing them. So we have kind of like retrofitted a couple of the barns. The one barn up in northeast Nebraska was actually a farrowing house, and they're no longer using it as a farrowing house. And it works perfect for us because it has the low ceilings, metal and cement floor, and so it works great. There's not a lot of loss in utilities.
Well, and you mentioned farms. How big of a building do you need for mealworms? To me, a worm wouldn't be very big, so I would think it would be fairly compact, but maybe you need more space than I think with the beetles and the worms.
No. We raise them in trays that are in vertical towers, so we can get a lot. I mean, we have millions and millions of worms in our buildings. And so you can maximize the space quite well by going up. And so basically the limit is the ceilings and also the height of the women. It becomes a limiting factor with that. But it's considered a controlled or confined environment agriculture. We have constant temperatures and humidity for optimum growing conditions.
Do you have to meet CAFO rules since you've got so many head under one roof?
What is that?
Confined animal feeding operations.
Oh, yeah. No. Well, not that I'm aware of, in a way, but we do try to keep so much distance in the trays as far as for the beetles for optimum reproducing to take place.
Sure. So where is the business headed then? I guess it must be doing well. You're continuing to grow?
We're continuing to grow. So we're looking at, so right now we're sending them live. The next step is to have them be used as a supplementary protein ingredient, whether it's in chicken feed, fish feed, aquaculture. That's probably the next level, or treats with certain, like small mammals type of treats. And then eventually the food industry. That's so live now. Dried. We're actually, like I said, I took product last week to a company that wants to start experimenting with the treats.
I doubt we will see large numbers of farmers beginning to grow insects, but it is an interesting idea and a good use for the old hog farrowing barn, now used to produce mealworms. You can find Cheryl on the web at yordproducers.com, and Yord is spelled J-O-R-D. Thanks for listening to this week's show. Catch up with us on Facebook and be sure to follow my daily syndicated broadcast, American Countryside, on Facebook or at AmericanCountryside.com. And for those of you interested in helping small towns and rural America survive, get all of our tips and stories at TotalTownMakeover.com. There are plenty of great resources there. We'll be back next week with another edition of Farming the Countryside. The Farming the Countryside podcast is brought to you by Pivot BioProven. Get what you paid for, the nitrogen that stays put, whether or not. Learn more at pivotbio.com.